Welcome to Weekly Insights at Winthrop Capital Management, where we discuss recent developments currently shaping the markets and industries in the global economy. Here's your host, Chief Investment Officer Greg Hahn.
Good morning. Happy Monday, everybody. I'm Greg Hahn, CIO for Winthrop Capital Management, and with me is Adam Kunz, Head of Trading and Portfolio Management with me. And we have special guest, Lance Birch, to talk with us about risk management. Lance does research, derivatives analysis, portfolio analysis, pretty much does everything for the firm. And also here is Linda Jackson, the quiet moral compass for the firm, Head of Marketing and Client Service. So with that, during the financial crisis, I think it was PIMCO coined the phrase the new normal. And it really was there to represent to describe the changes that the economy and the capital markets that would persist as we went through these changes as a result of the financial crisis. Today, we have something akin to the next new normal, because we're navigating this global pandemic, plus these aggressive monetary policies and the impact that it has on the capital markets and the economy. And it's really morphed or warped what that new normal was. And that includes everything from social distancing to furloughs and layoffs to wearing masks to curbside pickup to all of these things that didn't exist before the pandemic. Now, we expect that we'll be living through this way of life through most of 2021. There's work on a vaccine. It's encouraging work, but really once the vaccine is even distributed, we still expect that we're going to have the repercussions of these social distancing rules. And the impact is going to be the economic recovery will be slow. But with that, we had a really, really strong rally in stocks and bonds. And that's underlying that rally. We've talked about this is not across the board. There's a concentrated focus of a number of companies in the indices that are leading that rally. The S&P 500 at one time was a very diversified index. Now it's rather concentrated. So the top five names represent 20% of the market value of the S&P 500. And that's largely tech. And so with that, investors have to deal with this recognition that we've got embedded idiosyncratic risk, not only across the index, but in certain sectors of the index. So today we thought we'd unpack that a little bit to help investors understand as we head into the end of the year what's going on with the market, and then understanding that it's not a broad market rally. It's concentrated, and that what's happening is masking some of the issues. So, Adam, I'm going to just turn it over to you. We'll just make this a conversation.
Yeah. So, I mean, you kind of hit on a few things there. The top five stocks did some math, have contributed 9.48% to the S&P 500's return this year. Now, if you look at the S&P 500 return so far this year, it's now up 3.5% after the declines over the last 3 weeks. So that means if you took out the top five stocks, we would be firmly negative year to date in the S&P 500. So that's that concentration.
So, and what are those five stocks? Just so our listeners can know what we're talking about.
So that's Microsoft, Apple, Facebook, Amazon, and Google. That's a combination of both Google shares.
Yep.
So it's pretty much all tech, like you said.
Right. So go ahead.
So then to kind of further what you're saying there, tech right now makes up 41% of the S&P 500, which we brought up a couple weeks ago. And just, you know, when you look at indexes, especially market cap weighted indexes, it's important to understand that they're essentially a type of momentum index where they continue to overweight the companies that are outperforming most recently, which usually leads into your largest holdings are your most stretched valuation company. So that's just kind of what happens when you have a market weighted index. And then in particular, we have such a dispersion of returns. It's kind of skewed the index even more so this year. Mm. So I think last week, you know, we kind of started digging into the sectors a little bit more, and in particular, the ETFs that are usable for sectors. And we found some, I guess, say alarming things. Well,
and we've known they've been there.
Yeah.
I think what we've really done is to say, okay, how do we want to manage these risks?
Sure.
Which is why Lance is here. And it's because of the anomalies that exist, we have to figure a way to position the portfolios for 2021 in a way that investors can, we got risk reward, and then we're not just riding the same wave,
right,
that we rode 2020.
Right.
So let's talk about, go ahead.
I was going to say, kind of the comment I made on Friday is, I think most investors aren't aware of these things and kind of let the index dictate how they invest rather than their objectives.
So we talked about emerging markets last week, mm-hmm. and how even though we think of emerging markets as diversified across a number of different countries that have growing GDPs, but that five stocks in the emerging market index are
the same thing, right?
Right?
Yeah,
it's
tech based. It's Chinese based.
And we said Alibaba's market cap is the size of Turkey's GDP.
Right.
And that's twice the size of South Africa. And so when you look at investing in the emerging market index, you're really getting this concentrated tech exposure, but you think you're really getting this diversified. Okay. Hey, I want to own a little bit of Egypt, a little bit
right.
of
all these little countries.
Right. That's yeah. a very small part of the index because China's 40% of the emerging market right. index. So what's another example?
So another example is the consumer discretionary ETF or sector. So when we're looking at the S&P 500 consumer discretionary, Amazon now makes up over 41% of that sector. There are a couple problems aside from the fact that it's basically dominating the return. So if you look at consumer discretionary, you think, wow, we were up in this sector, but it's obviously driven predominantly by two stocks. That's Nike and Amazon. One of the problems is that there's not a pure play that really matches that sector. So the Spider sector ETF, which is the largest sector ETF used for consumer discretionary, actually only has Amazon weighted at 23%, mm-hmm. which has led to it underperforming the sector it's supposed to track by over 5% year to date.
Yeah, but still, even at 23, that's almost a quarter of the index.
Well, yeah.
25% of the index represented by one stock. Now, the reason this is important is when you think of consumer discretionary, you think of McDonald's and Home Depot and Nike, right?
So, sure.
So when you've got Amazon, you've got two businesses.
You do.
So Amazon Web Services is their IT cloud business. So year to date, here's the numbers. Year to date, Amazon did $9.8 billion in operating income. How much of that was Amazon Web Services? 65%. So $6.4 billion came from AWS. That's a tech company hidden inside of a consumer discretionary right. sector. That therein lies the issue.
Right.
And it's done great, right? Because it's
yeah, it's worked.
It's worked. But the problem is when all of those COVID-affected industries really do start to recover, and we see a rotation out of this tech into normalized into some of those traditional sectors, I think it's really going to have an impact on portfolio structure, on how performance of these underlying sectors. Financials. Let's talk about financials.
Yeah.
Did you get a chance to look at that?
I did. This was a fun one. So Berkshire Hathaway makes up almost 16% of the financial sector, which has really helped the financial sector stay, I guess, not as bad. So it's down 28% year to date, the sector is. But Berkshire Hathaway is only down 7%. So if you remove that, you've got a sector, like when you just look at the banking sector, which is down 40% year to date, roughly. So obviously Berkshire Hathaway is a big piece of that index and helping it. So when you dig into Berkshire Hathaway and say, well, what do they own? Well, 40% of their portfolio is a tech stock, Apple.
Right.
So effectively, so I did the math. So if Berkshire is 16% of the financial sector and 40% of the portfolio is Apple, that essentially means Apple is 6% of the financial sector.
Yeah.
So if you think of it in those terms, higher level, that means you add another 56 basis points of Apple to what people think they own when they own the S&P 500, essentially.
Well, here to put it in another perspective, too, when you look at the financial sector, you got Berkshire Hathaway at 15.9%.
Yeah.
The next largest is J.P. Morgan at 10.8%, and then Bank of America at 6.8%.
Mm-hmm.
So I did the math, this assumes, by the way, that we look at Berkshire Hathaway as a mutual fund.
Sure.
So then we're looking through to its holdings. So 44% puts it at, I had it at 7%, which makes it the third largest financial holding in the financial sleeve as a tech company.
Yeah.
So it's warped.
It is.
And you know, it's what's working. And that's masking, I think, because Apple's done so well. I mean, it's a $2 trillion company. Its performance has been outstanding this year. So it's elevated. And by the way, that still ignores the amount of Apple that's held inside the wealth management divisions of,
sure,
of BlackRock and JP Morgan and all these other firms. So there's this kind of this other risk in there that it's probably more than 7%, but there's a correlated risk.
Absolutely.
So with that, let's shift to Lance. Lance, how should investors look at the risk in the portfolios and how to manage this type of risk?
I mean, I think the most important thing to realize right now where we're sitting is that the next 3 to 5 months are probably not going to be smooth no matter what. So if you look at the VIX futures curve right now, I mean, spot VIX is about 26, but you have an upward sloping VIX futures curve, which is not usual. So the market's expecting a lot of volatility in November, December, and January.
Is there an election in November?
So that's coming up, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. So I guess in my mind, a lot of that expected volatility could be tail risk. So if you have the probability of a really large outlier event, I think you want to start to think about how to position your portfolio to kind of play a little defense. Because even that like low 30s, the VIX futures towards the end of the year, I think that's probably even a little low, because I mean, there's a lot of things that are interacting right now.
Right. So for long only investors, so we're going to take the short part out of it, because obviously there's some strategies for derivatives that can help mitigate risk. And we would cut to the chase and tell you those are really expensive strategies for individual investors. Yeah. So for long only investors, what should we consider?
I think the first thing to look at, or at least consider, is low volatility equity strategies. So there's a few different ways that they can be created, but it kind of eliminates some of the problems with cap-weighted indexes, because these are either constructed as minimum variance portfolios, or they have screens that eliminate some of the higher volatility names.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of eliminates some of the problems with the idiosyncratic risk and the risk of having some of the more volatile names. So that's one way to play some defense.
So in our models right now, we, and this is since the financial crisis, even during the financial crisis, we've always overweight U.S. domestic, particularly U.S. large cap, and it's worked. We've seen there's a growing issues around geopolitical risks around the globe. We've seen the pandemic has hit globally, has hit other countries harder than it's hit the United States from an economic standpoint. We've seen slowing global growth. But do you see a period 5 to 10 years out where you search the world over, and are the best investments going to be in the United States, or can you see a paradigm where it's shifted and it's you see better opportunities for investment overseas?
I mean, at some point, the valuation differential, you either have to have, continued economic dominance of the United States over the long term, or you have to see higher returns on international stocks.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think at some point, you're going to see a turn where the premium that people are paying for United States stocks isn't going to be justified over, maybe it's not in the next 5 years, but over some period.
Well, and really right now, the only place that the only legitimate challenge to that would be China with its economic numbers, because Europe is really struggling through the pandemic, and they've issued the euro bond, the euro denominated bond for the first time. And but they're struggling to put money to work in some of these countries that have been really affected that rely on tourism, like Italy. All right, let's shift to the bond market.
Yep.
So in the bond market has its own set of challenges because of low interest rates. So one of the things that's happened is the Fed has basically said during the pandemic, we see global growth slowing. The Fed's said we expect to see low interest rates into 2024. And talking the market down, talking interest rates down, that has had a significant shift in the risk in the bond market. So what are you seeing?
So you nailed it. Now we don't have the concentration risk. That's, I guess, one advantage. But when you look at the index, the biggest thing is duration has extended. So from the time period of 1992 to 2012, the U.S. aggregate stayed roughly 4.5 year duration. Now, obviously went up and down, but the average was 4.5. Since then, it has continued to extend. And today we're sitting at a 6.05 duration on the U.S. aggregate index. So once again, if you're a passive investor, you're taking on more duration risk in a time when you're less compensated on the rate side. We talked multiple times about how treasuries at this point are almost zero coupon bonds. And so the duration of the bond you're buying is essentially the maturity. So we're seeing that extension. And then when you look at the credit index, that is extended even further. So similarly, in 1992, it was a 4.5 year duration. As of Friday, it was 8.10 years. So if you're just in the credit index, you're even longer as you've seen more and more companies term out their debt.
Right. So with that really, to say that differently, is that companies, instead of laddering their bond maturities, this is an incentive for them to issue long-dated debt and actually do it at a borrowing cost that's significantly lower than
right.
they were borrowing 10 years ago. So it makes
yep.
sense for them to issue 30-year,
yep.
and in some cases, 40 or 50-year debt.
Yep.
And still not affect their interest expense. So part of the shift in the U.S. ag is the larger portion of the ag that's represented by U.S. treasuries.
Sure.
So the way the ag is put together, right, they have a minimum threshold. Every bond that is above $200 billion in issuance, I think, goes in the index.
$350 billion.
So but as the treasury issues more and more debt, U.S. treasuries become a bigger part of the ag.
Right.
So that's over 65% of the ag
it now
is U.S. treasuries. U.S. Treasury, the U.S. Treasury still has their calendar for issuing 3-year, 5-year, 7-year, 10-year, 30-year.
Yep.
Okay. So, and then who buys U.S. treasuries?
I mean, a lot of entities do, a lot of countries do, but right now the natural buyer is the Fed.
So we're running this $3 trillion budget deficit. The way the deficit's funded is through treasury issuance. We expect that we're going to continue to run deficits over the next 3 to 5 years just because of the lack of tax revenue and the increased spending in order to support the economy. So what does this mean for treasury issuance and then ultimately the fiscal shape of the U.S. government? Should investors be concerned?
I guess I'll let you take that one.
Happy Monday, everybody.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I think long term, I mean, it's, I guess, even pre-COVID, the debt to GDP ratios were starting to get, in the worry range. Now
we're at 100%.
But
Japan's over 200%.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, one thing to note is the change in the Fed's, operating paradigm to the average inflation targeting, which I'm guessing this is something that's been covered quite a bit. But the change, when they announced the change, the expected future CPI inflation numbers by their own determination were under 2% for the next 4 years. So if you're expecting to fail, it's not really a great policy. So, I mean, that's kind of one thing that's potentially comforting, is that even though there's a lot of monetary stimulus, it's not necessarily easy monetary policy at this point. So even though we have really high debt to GDP levels, there might be, I guess, in my opinion, some more room until you get to the point where you're considered really easy monetary policy.
Mm-hmm. So what else is there? This is a lot to unpack on a Monday morning. The important takeaway for investors that are listening and financial advisors listening is that this is really about managing risk, and the risks, we just don't assume that just because it worked this way 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, that it's going to work the same way going forward. We have some really tectonic shifts that are taking place in the structure of our economy and our capital markets, and it's compounded because of this pandemic. In some cases, I think this is accelerating issues. So bad business models that weren't working are being accelerated. New forms of business models. We could argue the electric car.
Sure.
You know, these are in some cases. And obviously the use of the internet for shopping these are accelerating things. So it's interesting to watch, but I think in terms of just how we invest, it's just being mindful of how these indices are structured and how the markets are being structured right now, where we manage or where we invest and how we manage that risk. So I want to thank you guys for joining us. And with that, we'll sign off and we'll talk to you guys during the week. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, guys.
All investments are subject to risk, including the possible loss of the money you invest. The information presented in this podcast is intended for educational purposes only and does not take into consideration your personal circumstances or other factors that may be important in making investment decisions. You may access and download this podcast only for your personal and non-commercial use. You may not use it in any other manner or for any other purpose without Winthrop's written permission. Copyright 2020, Winthrop Capital Management, LLC. All rights reserved.